That was really a fun children's time, isn't it? I'm that guy. Find something you love to do and you'll never have to work a day in your life, said Harvey McKay, businessman, author, and columnist. For some of us, this really does work out. Finding a vocation that one really loves and enjoys so much that it never really seems like work. My brother Tom is the best example I know of this. His job as sports writer, covering local sports for the Rutland Herald, is his passion. About his job, he has said, "Every day is like being a kid getting up on Christmas morning and opening presents." To quote a Dire Straits song, "That ain't working, that's the way you do it." And Dire Straits goes on to say, "You play the guitar on the MTV." Tom's lyrics might be, "That ain't working, that's the way you do it. You write about sports from A to Z." But for each person who has found such a great fit for them in work, there are many, many more who just have jobs. Or perhaps they do find meaningful jobs or professions, but they're not exactly like opening Christmas presents every day. So let's look at avocation. What pastimes, hobbies, artistic, athletic pursuits, apart from our jobs, are meaningful to us, and how so? I want to start with a story taken from this summer's issue of UU World, an article appearing in the Ideas Forum by Anthony McCarr, who authored our opening words, titled "The Wisdom of Play." He starts the article with this story. A Boston College psychology researcher was invited by a couple of 10-year-old girls he knew to join in their game of Scrabble. The girls were novices, and he saw this as a teaching opportunity. But here's how their game was played. Their unstated but obvious goal on each turn was to put down the longest, funniest, nonsense word they could, using as many letters as possible from their rack, combined with at least one letter on the board. They had to follow the rules of English phonology, or Edward, as they put it, had to sound like it could be a word. But it could not be an actual word. The object was not to score points, but to make each other laugh. And laugh they did. They laughed like only two high-spirited 10-year-old girls who had long been best friends can laugh. Sometimes one would challenge the other's word, asking for a definition. And the other would offer an hysterical definition that somehow seemed to fit the way the word sounded. And then they would laugh even harder. I realized as I pulled back and watched them and began to laugh along with them that my way of playing was something like what we usually call work. Their way of playing was play. I realized too that I used to play like that as a child. What had happened to me? McCarr's article goes on to give the five factors of play, all illustrated by the Scrabble story. I'll summarize them here. 1, activity freely entered into. 2, participants are self-determining. 3, full of imagination. 4, done primarily for the sake of fun. 5, completely absorbing. Concluding the article, McCarr says, "Maybe the playful approach really can release us to get past whatever is hard for us. A little bit of play can go a long way." Having read this article, and I encourage you to read it also, I think much of our pastime activities are really more like work than play. While volunteer or charitable work, for example, are meaningful, they are most often our work, not play. Exercise programs, fitness activities, and sports can also be more like work than play. Game addictions, gambling, TV habits don't meet the criteria for play either. In fact, much of what we consider to be entertainment does not meet the criteria. But I don't mean to equate meaningfulness with playfulness. There's certainly value in meaning in charitable work and fitness. So let's just say, if we recognize the value of play as fun, let's try to apply the principles to the activities that are appropriate. For example, if certain outdoor activities are your passion, try applying the play principles. Immerse yourself freely in that bike ride, hike, golf run, kayaking, bird watching activity. Be self-determining in your approach. Apply imagination to your route or process. Be absorbed in it in the appreciation of our natural world. And do it for fun. And this logically leads us directly to a discussion of golf and mysticism. Well, maybe this is a stretch, but it's what I want to talk about now anyway. But first, I want to say I did decide to apply the aforementioned play principles to a recent round of golf. You see, every time I play my home course, I do it pretty much exactly the same, though not always getting the same results. Since the first four holes collectively are round-determining nemesis of mine, in the spirit of playfulness, I decided to hit a completely different than usual club off of each of those four tees. The results were interesting. The scores for those holes were not bad, and I played the rest of the round conventionally and had one of my better rounds of play, and it was fun. Now, back to golf and mysticism. Michael Murphy, on a family-owned property of 127 acres on California Big Sur Coast, co-founded Esalen Institute in 1962. Briefly, Esalen was founded to explore human potential, such things as Eastern spirituality, alternative mind-body practices, Gestalt therapy. And in 1971, he wrote his first and most famous book, Golf in the Kingdom. My 1970s copy. rewinding chronologically, in 1956, Michael, at age 26, had given up his pre-med studies at Stanford to pursue psychology and religious studies. He was on a one-day layover in Scotland, en route to India to study meditation, and played a round of golf. On this real experience, he bases his book, Golf in the Kingdom. That is, on this experience plus much embellishment, imagination, creative writing, to produce mostly pure fiction, thought-provoking, and great fun. Michael Murphy, the one in the book, the mostly fictional Michael, though he is Michael, meets and golfs with the larger-than-life philosophizing golf pro Shivas Iyers. In his youth in the 1930s, we learned that Shivas was a very shy, lacking in confidence, awkward fellow with an enormous talent for golf. His home club of Burning Bush Golf Links in the town of Burning Bush, Scotland, recognized this talent and encouraged and sponsored him to play in the British Amateur Golf Competition. He was terrified and intimidated. But in his final round of golf, something magical happened. He connected with the gallery, and in this powerful but intangible connection, he found himself, his confidence, his calling, and incidentally, victory. He won the British Amateur Championship. Shivas found his calling not to be a professional golfer, but to be a teaching pro, exploring and teaching the mystical connection he experienced. Shivas and Michael, with golf as common denominator, quickly develop a friendship and connection. After a real journey of a golf round, with Shivas imparting a bit of his wisdom, they find themselves in Scottish style, drinking and philosophizing with the locals. One of the party, a doctor named Julian, goes into a negative rant against thought in modern times. I'll read a bit of that in a minute. Friend, the theory you propose about the improvements of the game, I'll show you how the game is fading away, losing its old charm, becoming mechanized by the Americans, and the rest of the world that blindly follows them. Look at the crowded links, the lack of leisure, the hurried starting times, the ruination of the old clubs where you could gather with your friends and enjoy some good conversation. We are all of us hypnotized, I tell you. And you're just refusing to look at the facts if you say it otherwise. Now golf reflects all this. You're right, Adam. It does indeed reflect all this. Oh, what an awful reflection. What an awful reflection. I see the distorted swings, the hurried rounds. And now the electric carts tame, ruin the courses and robust of our exercise. In the configuration of physique that shows me how our twisted lives twist our bodies. I don't think evolution is going ahead so much as just going along and breathing more on fitness every day. We've got off the mark, gone for the wrong things, forgotten what it's all about, gotten ourselves hypnotized by silly people. Why? The work of Shiva's here and Seamus McDuff. I would say there's no hope left at all. Pardon my lame brogue. And Shivas replies, William, you made it difficult for me to sing the praises of golf. There's something like the final word about your speech. I think we need Agatha's blessing now if we are to proceed. Now, Agatha was the hostess, and in these days, you know, Scotland, 1950s, women pretty much didn't play golf. It was a man's sport. And Agatha spoke about golf and about the love men have for one another. It's the only reason we play at all, she said. It's a way we find to get together and maintain a proper distance. I know you, man. You're not like women. Or Italians hugging and embracing each other. Ye need to feel your separate love. Just look, you wouldn't come home on time if you're with the boys. Oh, I learned that over the years. The love you feel for your friends is too strong for that. All these gentlemanly rules, why, they're the proper rules of affection. All the waiting and wooing and on over your shots. On the top, or this one's drive, and that one's putt. The other one's gorgeous swing. What is it all but love? Men loving men, that's what golf is. Strong lines of our face were softened by the fire's glow. I think the loss of love is Julian's real despair, whatever his philosophizing tells him. He misses the leisurely pace when there was time for more affection. Now don't you, Julian? I miss it too. Most of the women miss it. The ones I know, we hurry through our days. She looked at Peter and shook his hand. And then she lifted back her head. Oh, golf is for smelling heather and cut grass and walking fast across the countryside and feeling the wind and watching the sun go down and seeing your friends hit good shots and hitting some yourself. It's love and it's feeling the splendor of this good world. There was music in our gentle Scottish burr, a fullness and a feeling for us. It was becoming obvious by now that each of us had a different song to sing in praise of the mysterious game. She was a sort of moved he could only then stare silently into the fire. Now, you heard mention of Seamus McDuff, the Shiva's irons. Seamus McDuff was Shiva's mentor. And this is a little passage about their meeting. By the way, this book, you don't have to be a golfer to enjoy this book. It's really more about life than golf. Shiva had spent the war years on the Scottish island in the North Sea as a lookout for enemy bombers on assignment that fit his talent for birding. He was on leave in Burning Bush when the meeting occurred. He had gone to pray in the old cathedral, something he'd always done even after he left the church. After his prayers, he walked into the adjoining burial ground as if he were drawn there. In front of a tomb commemorating a famous golfer stood Seamus MacDuff. Seamus had seen the old man when he was a child, going around on the local course on a white Shetland pony. He was one of the great characters of the town in the 1920s, a prosperous, eccentric inventor who had discovered certain engineering principles that led to the development of missiles and supersonic flight. His aloof and imperious ways endeared him to many in Burning Bush and outraged others, especially because of his African ancestry. He was so at odds with the traditions of membership in the club. He was the son of a wealthy Scotch merchant who had made a fortune in the African trade, and a voodoo princess from the Gold Coast. His father had imagined himself a kind of Richard Burton bringing back the lore of the primitive mind, and in the course of his travels, he had met the clairvoyantly gifted black woman who eventually gave birth to Seamus. The youngster had been raised in his mother's tribe and tutored in British ways by teachers his father sent to the Gold Coast. He was then sent to Oxford when he was 17. His eventual fascination with the dark underside of modern science undoubtedly derived from his African voodoo roots. He sometimes compared himself to Amenhotep IV, the monotheistic pharaoh known as Akhenaten. He was also a combination of northern and southern genes. In any case, Seamus' swarthy face and white bristling beard confounded many of the people of Burning Bush, who had never seen anyone like him. His habit of riding around the links on a Shetland pony only heightened the impact of his startling presence. He had gone into seclusion sometime before 1930, no one knew why. Some thought he was mad. Others said he got bankrupt while developing a new scheme for harnessing power. Now he stood gazing at the statue as Seamus approached. Without turning, he said, "You and I have much to do, for these are our final days." If I correctly remember Seamus' account, their collaboration started immediately, Seamus following his new protege around the Burning Bush links as they had their first seminar on true gravity. In the years that followed, they worked on the relations between consciousness and physical laws, Seamus being the theorist and Seamus his practitioner in the world of golf. He hinted that the old wizard had other areas in which he was trying his theories, that many other human activities would be transformed one day in the knowledge of true gravity and the luminous body. Hiroshima was the beginning of the end, according to Seamus MacDuff. It was the final sign that man must discover the secrets of the soul or go the way of dying species. The discovery of atomic weapons had come too soon before the deeper revelations of science that were ultimately meant to be. Evolution had taken an awful turn, and there was not much time to right the balance. He was studying the golfer's tomb that day in the cathedral burial ground because he and Seamus had to make golf a matter of life and death. It was an appropriate place for them to meet. So, you can see this is not so much about golf. In fact, in the book, Michael is invited into Seamus Iron's study, which is a study filled with books on religion and philosophy, as well as sports. And I'm going to read just a few of Seamus Iron's History of the Western World notes. They were in this journal. He had a triple list that went like this. Inventions, what could be soon, what will eventually be. Inventions, airplanes and automobiles, what could be soon. Ravine jumps, what will be eventually. Full flight and true gravity. Inventions, telephones, what could be soon. Urgent telepathic messages. What will eventually be? The divine silence. Inventions. Newspapers. What could be soon? Intuition of the world state. What will eventually be? Omniscience and self-existent delight. Inventions. Hydrogen bombs. What could be soon? Psychokinetic blasts. What will eventually be? Explosions of ecstasy. So, Shivas was he's such a believable character. Michael Murphy says he still has a relationship with this character he developed 25 years ago. It's a very real personality for him. So I'm going to end with a quote, or an excerpt of an interview with Michael Murphy, a more recent excerpt. The question is golf the only sport that invites mystical experience? Or is this state possible in any athletic pursuit? And Michael Murphy replies, in my book, In the Zone, this is another book he's written, Transcendence in Sports, called In the Zone. I describe mystical states attained through other sports like mountain climbing and in long ocean voyages, particularly solo circumnavigations. There are instances of this kind of experience in every sport, but some sports give rise to it more easily than others. It's the spirit of concentrated play. Golf is right at the top, along with mountain climbing, single-handed sailing, and flying airplanes. These are sports that require tremendous vigilance and open you up to the elements, and they go on for hours and hours. The depth of experience is proportional to the amount of time you spend in this altered state. It becomes a journey of surrender. If you do something only for a few minutes, you don't have time to experience these larger states of being. As Nietzsche said, there's nothing more serious than a child at play. And one more of his answers in this interview was this. Right now, the human race prefers comfort to adventure. The irony is that we have been offered everything again and again and again, and we keep turning away. It's all right in front of us, right this very instant. We just need a vision of it and a practice through which we can go into it. It's ironic how some people will go around the world to marry the girl next door. Now remember, all humans are shapeshifters. All of us aspire to what I call hyperdimensional luminous embodiment. Secretly, we all know in certain moments that we are more than this frail human flesh. We are more than what our parents, our teachers, our priests, and rabbis told us we were. And the world is much more than they told us it was. I share the perception with Shiva's audience that we are only just getting started. So that concludes my discussion of golf in the kingdom.